Broadcasting from Icon Gallery in beautiful downtown Fairfield, Iowa, it's Icon Art Radio with Alan Cobb, Donna Colby, and Bill Teeple. All right, Gertrude Stein.
Yes, last
Paris,
show.
Paris, France.
Last show we started with a Gertrude Stein quote, and this is a different one, completely different from the other one. This one, she was actually having a conversation with a writer who was sort of stuck, who said that he had a book in him and he wasn't really, you know, he knew what he wanted to say, but he didn't know how to begin or how to resume. I guess he had started and couldn't and was in a stuck place. So she said to him, "The way to resume is to resume. It is the only way to resume. If you feel this book deeply, it will come as deep as your feeling is when it is running truest, and the book will never be truer or deeper than your feeling. But you do not yet know anything about your feeling, because though you may think it is all there, all crystallized, you have not let it run. So how can you know what it will be? What will be best in it is what you really do not know now. If you knew it all, it would not be creation, but dictation." So I thought we could relate that not only to writing, but any of the arts.
Well, I think when you stand in front of the canvas, it's a voyage of discovery. We talk about the classical and the romantic, though. I think there's different kinds of people and different ways of approaching. I'm sure that Gertrude Stein was a little bit more in the romantic angle, in which you set out on the journey and you find your way to the goal. But you have to have in mind a goal. I mean, you have to know what, you have to feel your way along to something that you're yearning for and that you have to see happen. So the romantic artist just goes for it, and it's a wild journey often with ups and downs and all of that. The classical artist is kind of the person that works it all out, has like a plan, almost like the plan to build a house in mind, and they spend a lot of time on the plan because the voyage of discovery for the classical artist pretty much is putting the plan together. Then the making of the painting is sort of almost like building the house. But I think both of them are voyages of discovery. The classical artist has to come up with a vision, an image, a composition that says it all. And that has to do with this sense of what you have to say and what's burning inside to get said. And then the romantic, of course, just launches into the blank canvas and gets there.
So the journey.
But I think all along it's a journey of discovery.
Yeah, and for the classical artist, the journey is just the beginning stage. The romantic artist, the way you were describing, just plunges in, and the beginning stage maybe just like a split second, and then they're in it. Whereas the classical artist, that split second of beginning the work is spread out for this long period of journey, where they're spending like a great deal of time in that phase of the project. But I would imagine even for the classical artist, like the builder of a house, once you actually start executing the work, the final work, you're going to run into things you didn't expect, something that just isn't working the way you thought it was going to work, and you have to tweak it and make adjustments.
And a classical artist can become a romantic overnight in the middle of his painting, too, so it's not a cut and dry thing. But the important thing here is that what makes a person an artist is that they're attempting to drive into manifestation some inner need that wants expressing, and that the job is to find out what that thing is and to get it into, it's an experience in consciousness being manifested physically in an object that holds that experience. And that's really quite a magic act.
Yeah, to me, the creative process is a little bit like politics, because they say so often that politics is the art of compromise. And the creative process is a continuum of compromise. You have this faint idea, you start to manifest it, you're not God, so what manifests isn't the faint idea, it's just sort of a hint of it. So you say, okay, well, given that, then we'll continue the manifestation this way. And that isn't quite it either, but the two together create a trend, and so you say, okay, we'll go with that, and it emerges in still more detail, but you're not entirely in control of the medium, and so it continues to be a compromise. You do what you can, and then you work with that, which isn't really what you had originally intended exactly. And so there's this constant sort of looping through trying something and manifesting another bit of it, and then having to deal with what you have manifested, because it never is, you know, the pure original idea.
That's really cool. I really like that, and the relationship that you made with politics and art, because when you think about it that way, it's like politics, polis, the word polis just means community, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. A city or a community. And so the whole field of politics really is just this process that you described of compromising with the entire group that's living in this polis, in this city, country, state, whatever group it is. And the same thing with when we're working as an artist, there are all sorts of elements that we're working with. There is the actual physical material of the paint and the or the clay or whatever it is. There are colors, there's form, there's space, there's, you know, our technical ability, our eye-hand coordination and all of that. And whatever our vision is, this driving force that you were talking about that's motivating us to do this thing, we have to keep bringing in respect for all of these other, the population of the realm of art that we're working in.
There's an HBO special that's been playing the last few weeks called The Gates, which is about the Christo installation in Central Park a few years ago. I think it was in 2005. And it's a fascinating documentary. I highly recommend it. I'm sure it'll be on DVD soon, and if it isn't already. But it shows Christo trying to get permission to do this ambitious and expensive installation, which he will be paying for himself, in Central Park for 2 weeks only. And he started 30 years ago. He started in the, I guess it's the late 70s. And you see him, he documents everything he does. So we have this films of him visiting the city officials and lawyers and advocates and people throwing parties to support the project and stuff. And then you have these scenes where people are coming in to like say something intelligent about what he's trying to do, and they've learned from school how to sound intelligent and how to, you know, and this one woman says, well, it seems to me that Central Park is itself a work of art. And so what you're suggesting is like putting a work of art on top of a work of art. And that would be like painting the Guernica on top of the Last Supper. And, you know, it's like, yeah, that was very clever, but that's got nothing at all to do with it. It's just completely irrelevant. But what was really striking to me about it was that somewhere along the line where you're expecting that Christo will try to justify what he's doing, he's confronted by all these people who are just coming up with silly reasons not to do it. You know, that there's some guy who lives in a low rent area of New York who says, well, I won't be able to see it because we don't have high rises in my neighborhood, so we won't be able to look at it. Only rich people will even be able to see it. And of course later, you know, you and 10,000 other people are walking through it in the park and everybody's totally delighted. But hearing all these fatuous complaints about it, you would expect Christo would come out with some, you know, attempt to justify what he's doing. And instead, what he says sums up what an artist is more beautifully than anything I've heard in a long time. And he says, I am not doing this as a contribution to the culture of New York. I'm not doing this as a favor or as a donation to the people who use Central Park. I am doing this because I'm crazy. I'm doing this because I have to do it. I've been trying to find a way to do this for, and this I guess is later in the thing, because 30 years later, he gets permission to do it by Bloomberg, who is a billionaire, is the mayor, and he's an art collector. So he's, Christo approaches him, and he's been approaching the city for 30 years, and Bloomberg says right off the bat, that's a great idea. Why don't you do it? I think you should do it. This is fantastic. And then Bloomberg talks it up, and all these naysayers just disappear. It just doesn't matter. Mm. But the way Christo says, I'm just doing it for myself. It's something I have to do. It's going to cost by now $10 million. And, you know, I am raising all the money myself. The city isn't spending any money on it at all, but it's not a gift to the city. It's an expression of something from inside of me that I have to do. Mm. And hopefully everyone will enjoy it, but whether they do or not has nothing to do with why I'm doing it.
That's a great story.
Yeah, it's a wonderful documentary, really.
So what year did he actually...
2005. It's impressive. I mean, it's really 30 years later, and he's 30 years older, and, you know, the whole cultural political scene that he would have to be dealing with is so different. I mean, the films of him trying to get permission from the 70s. Are now, just depressing in the extreme.
But that in itself is brilliant, that he actually made films of himself of these, you know, like, I just think that would be an amazing thing to see in the life of any artist is
Well, especially an installation artist. I mean, in my brief career as an installation artist, the one thing that's really clear is that after the installation, you got nothing. Mm-hmm. So if you don't document it, then... Yeah. That's it, you know. I mean, it's not to say you have to have something when you're done, but if you ever wanted to sell your work, and Christo pays for it by selling his work. I mean, he sold the sketches of what he wanted to do, and then he sold the pictures of what he did. Mm. But it's quite wonderful. It's very inspiring. The whole thing is just utterly delightful. The only thing they don't cover is afterwards. They take you right up to the last day of it, and then that's the end. Hmm. And there's no indication of what happened to all of these. He used 75% as much steel as the Eiffel Tower.
Wow!
Building this thing. I want to know what happened to all those pieces. He's got these steel base plates to keep the arches from tipping over. Hmm. And the arches are made of welded aluminum square channel that's, you know, like 6 or 8 inches square, and enameled bright orange. And then these saffron curtains made of ripstop nylon hanging down. And there's 3,000 of these.
Wow.
It's hundreds of tons of steel and aluminum and ripstop nylon. Where did it all go? Did
sure
he sell it on
out.
eBay? I mean, can you buy an arch from that? I mean, you'd think collectors would
want
some
of
them.
Well, you'd think that would be available.
Yeah.
Is the series over then?
And you didn't it's not a series. It's just one.
But I mean, it's a series of, it's just, oh, it's just one.
It's just
like
a 90-minute program.
Oh, I thought it was like over several.
No, no.
So what's the name of the
It's called
film?
The Gates.
The Gates.
And I think it's HBO Films, but I'm not certain. Mm. You know, if you go to HBO.com, I'm sure if it's available, it'll be very easy to find.
Well, what you were saying about how they didn't show what happened afterwards reminded me of how fascinating the Andy Goldsworthy film is, Rivers and Tides, where it shows his construction of these transitory projects in nature, and how some of the most moving points in the movie are what happens afterwards when the tide comes in and destroys the structure, or when he just places the wrong one stone slightly askew and the whole thing falls over. And you know, but that's the beauty of that kind of an art form.
And he is a very accomplished photographer, and mm-hmm. he definitely beautifully documents his work, and it's not lost forever. It's not quite
that's part of the work.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. That's yeah. what I mean. And it's not quite as pure as the, you know, the Tibetan sand painting, where the whole point is that it's gone and there shouldn't even be a record of it. Of course, the tourists will take pictures, but.
Well, and to go back to the Gertrude Stein quote, if you continue on with her conversation with this writer, she talks about, you know, you don't know what's going to come out until you start writing, and the writing will bring it out and in a often surprising form. But she also says, no person is a one-book author, because your life goes on and your resources just are continually being replenished inside yourself, and your experiences pile up on top of other experiences. And the more you, you know, for your entire life as an artist, you express things every day, and you don't know how in the end it's all going to blend together, and some of it will disappear and some of it will pile on top of itself and create something amazing.
Yeah.
Well, you sort of set something in motion. That's why this resume or this start mm-hmm. is so important, because you just begin acting mm-hmm. and you're going to act as long as you've got breath, and that whole time you were an artist and you were making art. And if you, I'm spacing out here.
Well, the resume point is really exciting in a way, because it, you know, it focuses right in on that moment that is the difference between thinking about something and actually doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a crucial point. I mean, it comes back to my, you know, blathering about modes. And there are times when I want to do something creative, but I can't get myself to start doing it. And I've found that if I simply go into a different part of the house or sit in a different position in a different room, that problem is gone. And it's very strange. But I, you know, writers, it's like writer's block. What do you do if you just can't write? Well, you write. That's mm-hmm. all you can do.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't have much to say over how it all bounces around in the
no.
universe. You know, its effect.
No, you have no idea.
Because there are artists that become very famous early in their career,
mm-hmm.
and the world identifies with them that work that they
yes.
did when they were young. But these people lived another 60 years, and they continued to make art and have their art had some influence in bigger and smaller ways.
Yeah.
And it may have taken on all different courses. And they continued, they weren't dead. Sometimes you feel like an artist is dead
mm-hmm.
after his work that causes a stir in the world.
Right.
But they're not. They're continuing to make art, and they're right. just continuing day after day to do what artists do. And I always want to see that work, you know, actually.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why it's so fascinating to me. I absolutely love seeing pictures of the insides of people's studios. No matter who they are, there's a website, hamletdobbins.com, I think it is. It's a photographer who went around the country and photographed a lot of different people's studios. And he has on this website, he has several different photographs of each artist's studio. Some of them are close-ups of the paintbrushes, and some of them are like more of a wide view of the studio. And you can just tune right into the personality of each artist depending on what the studio is. But for me, just looking at those photographs acts as a catalyst for my creativity. All I have to do is visit it for a few minutes online, and I will feel like making art.
Yeah.
It just...
Yeah, it sets up a different mode. It's like there's a big color wheel in your head or something. And if you get the wrong color stuck in front of your eyes, then you don't do anything, and all you got to do is turn the wheel a little bit and get a different section in there, and you're a different person.
Well, and
it's just a non-stopping voyage. You know, that's what people don't quite understand. An artist, at some point, some baby that was born recognizes that he's someone that can express himself in these ways, and at that moment, he's an artist, and the whole thing is just a voyage. until there's no more breath left. Mm-hmm. And these things that are artifacts of that journey get stuck up now and then for people to look at. They're almost like snapshots along the way. And he's attempting to drive as much as possible into each work, and so there's this attempt to drive the total universe into a point and set that on a pedestal. But there's varying degrees of success and failure of that. But that's why the studio is so beautiful, because the combination of the studio, which represents the journey, with these points where he's tried to encapsulate as much as possible along the journey into a kind of snapshot, it all is a whole that is very moving, and you get the most out of that. Because then you identify, your awareness becomes identified with another awareness having gone through that journey. And it takes you through that journey too, and you're expanded because of it.
I love what you just said about the work of art being an artifact of that process, and we happen to just put these artifacts up in galleries and museums. And I mean, the actual word museum is like a temple to the muses. And so in that context, that's exactly what it is. What you put in this temple as objects to revere when you go into the museum are the effects, the after effects of this driving force that you talked about earlier in the show.
So the person is kind of responsible on making himself as finely developed as he can be. I mean, that's the thing to do. Mm-hmm. So everything you do and that you share from your fine journey will have that level of fine-tuning.
Mm-hmm. And it's like an interaction, the fine-tuning, going back to the muses, what, you know, you talked about the driving force, and people have called it the muse, but whatever we call it, it's a constant communication that we're having with that. You know, any relationship we have with any person we're close to depends on the depth of communication we have with the person. And if we're communicating with that driving force or our muse, it has to be, you know, we have to be like aware enough to keep that dialogue going.
Well, otherwise you become a copier of your own artifacts, mm-hmm. and the journey's over.
Yeah. Picasso actually said that was his greatest fear, of copying himself. He said, I'll copy anybody else because it's always going to be original. You know, my inspiration or imitation of somebody else's work, but he had a horror of being tempted to copy his own work.
It's such a delicious irony that the outsider would be thinking copying someone else's work is the least creative thing you could do.
Right.
But it's still far more creative than copying yourself.
Mm. But I think artists congregate in places like Paris and New York and these centers, so that they can copy each other, so that they can draw from each other. Because otherwise you will be just not growing. You'll just be, you know, you want somebody to challenge where you think it is so that you can expand.
Because it's like a community of artists. They're like jazz musicians who are improvising with each other, you know, and they're each kind of doing their own thing, but they're also paying attention to what everybody else is doing and playing off the inspirations of others. And it can be a beautiful thing, whether it's a collaborative work of art or just, you know, inspiring each other.
Well, and in life in general, you know, we're teaching each other. Mm-hmm. We each bump into someone at a time when we haven't figured out the next step, and the other person says something that seems obvious to them, and we realize, oh yes, of course, thank you, you know, that's what I needed to know. Mm-hmm. And then a week later the roles are reversed and it happens again.
Or you hear it on the radio.
Or you hear it on Icon Art Radio.
To the radio and something we say, or one of the other people, the hundreds of people who have shows on Crew FM, might say something that's just exactly what you needed to hear at that moment, and it sparks you. I like to open books at random. If I'm stuck and don't know a direction to go in, I'll just go grab, sometimes I'll even walk into the library, close my eyes, walk down a row of books, pull a random book off the shelf and open it up and see what's on that page. And it just gives me a different perspective, whatever the book happens to be.
Well, you'll probably find that there's a huge cult built around whatever point that was that you discovered. That
right, there's probably a website and a whole bunch of groupies and maybe
there's
mugs
a whole
and
world
t-shirts.
Of that, and there's collectors of it, and there's fanatics of it. And you wouldn't dream of it. So it's like, it's amazing, it's expanded you to start to look into something and seeing, you know, I'm taking this so serious, but this person's taking that so serious, that person's taking that so serious. And it's just there's a vertical dive with each point.
Well, now that's an interesting point to bring out too, in terms of art being an artist, is that some artists are actually kind of on a mission that is very one-pointed. A Japanese calligrapher, let's say, you know, who spends an entire lifetime perfecting a certain brush stroke and all, and that's the focus. And other artists are, like Picasso, are all over the place, just never sticking to one medium. And that's equally valid, depending on what your journey happens to be.
I guess we should once again remind our listening audience that all of the Icon Art Radio programs are available on icon-art.org.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.